Clearly, our job here today is to tell the investment story here in Central Texas. We've had a lot of very exciting activity in the last couple of years, and I'm very happy to report that you guys are sitting amongst some of the regions and the states, and of course, I would argue some of the country's finest investors. So I think I am going to give each one of you guys a little bit of an introduction, and then we'll have you tell us where you are on the investment continuum. I'll also give you guys some local statistics here, local meaning Austin and the state of Texas, up on the screen. When I say we've been busy, I mean it. Those are some great numbers we're really proud of. So it's my absolute pleasure to introduce Andrew Busey here directly to my left. I think many of you know Andrew. He's pretty famous here in Austin and around the country. He's here today to represent Austin Ventures. He's also an individual investor and really recognized as a visionary in the industry. He's really he's pioneered some of the industry's most influential web technologies, including iChat, WebCenter, and Mosaic, and was recently, as many of you know, the CEO and founder of Challenge Games, which sold to Zynga. Morgan Flager is sitting next to Andrew. He's here to represent Silverton Ventures. Morgan arrived on the Austin stage in 2006, a transplant from San Francisco, where he worked for FTV Capital. And he held, previous to that, numerous executive positions at companies including Ingrian Networks and Quintana. Rudy Garza, G51. The first thing, actually, you should know about Rudy is that he's a major UT fan. He sits on the board, actually, of the... Yeah,
welcome. There. Eric, yeah, feel the love.
Rudy founded G51 in 1996 and has served on over 20 boards of publicly traded strategic acquirers, including SAP, ADP, and Cisco. And he is very actively involved in the national and the Texas Venture Capital Associations. Jamie Rhodes, last but certainly not least. Jamie's also a big celebrity here in Austin, Texas. He's the founder and chairman of the board of the Central Texas Angel Network, and he sits on the board of directors of the Angel Capital Association. He's going to tell some stories today about the recent national conference that he hosted for the organization. He is an investor and board member of Skyonic and numerous other startup advisory boards that he will also tell us about. And we should also mention that Jamie is a big Aggie, so I'm hoping that you and Rudy are not going to get into a tussle down.
Okay, get that straight. Now, I'm half Aggie and half Longhorn, so I'm an Aghorn. It's okay. Goliath 1 and Goliath 2.
Very good. Jamie, why don't you, actually, if you don't mind, start us out. Just give us a little bit of an overview with regard to CTAN. What are the types of investments that CTAN looks for? What are the sort of average investments that you guys make?
Well, I will, but since we're Austin-focused, I think it's important to talk about why Austin is great. And the reason it's great is we're a team. We've been working together for decades, literally. And in this room right now, for example, just dropping by to kind of see what's going on, we have a number of stalwarts in our Austin scene. So we have Pike Powers Sr. and Pike Powers Jr. here, the Pike brothers, the Power brothers. Pike is the guy who put us on the map. He brought MCC and Semitech here. He's the godfather of Austin in the way it is now. We have Bob Metcalf. He invented the Internet. No, the Ethernet. And he's a superstar, and he's now at UT helping commercialization, getting startups and entrepreneurship roaring at UT. And Bajoy, who started Bootstrap Austin many years ago, wave Bajoy. And bootstrapping, I love to remind people that the reason Michael Dell's a billionaire and still running his company is because he bootstrapped it and got it off the ground that way instead of taking investment. As far as angel investment goes, and I'm sure there are many other dignitaries I just haven't noticed because of the low lights, by the way. Angel investors typically invest from the $200,000 to $2 million range is what's comfortable for them. The Central Texas Angel Network, I'm very pleased to say, is one of the top five angel networks in activity in the nation. We're up there with Tech Coast Angels, which is actually a California-wide group. I mean, it's four or five angel networks that all work together. CTAN, Central Texas Angel Network, is up there at that level with investment activity. We invested last year in about 16 companies. About half of those were new rounds, and half of those were follow-on rounds with our companies. And that was to the tune of about $6 million total. We've also organized the angel groups around the state of Texas into something we call the Alliance of Texas Angel Networks. And that dozen or so very active angel networks around the state in 2010 invested about $24, $25 million in 50 or 60 companies. And in 2011, we haven't totaled the numbers yet, but I think it'll be about twice that. So about $50 million in angel investment activity in the state of Texas.
Next. G51 Capital, we're here because we ride on the shoulders of giants, and the angels are some of those giants as well as the more traditional venture capitalists. And we've been fortunate to take advantage of the wave of angel investors across the country, as well as the more recent wave of incubators and accelerators that are popping up all across the country. We invest nationally. And we're very collaborative. So our typical investment is $500,000, and we generally lead the Series A investment, and those Series A's are typically $500,000 to maybe a couple of $1 million. We often team up with other angels or smaller venture groups or, you know, in later stages, some of the bigger venture groups as well. And so we try to fill... I sort of call the startup landscape 1.0 is team and initial product. 2.0 is kind of commercialization, first breakout revenue. 3.0 is growth capital and really scaling. And so we tend to operate in 2.0 and work very diligently to help companies find that first vein of opportunity on the revenue side to where we get them up and rolling to where we can have a line of sight to, you know, $1 million, $2 million, $5 million in revenue. And when we're successful at that, and we consistently have been successful at it, we tend to find amazing partners to team with in syndications. And so we've teamed both with Austin Ventures, and we've teamed with Morgan's group, Silverton, and that's essentially the lay of the landscape and where we like to invest.
And we'll come back to that syndication story. That's an important story. I want to make sure we...
I did want to add that 3 years ago, 90% of our deal flow was in Texas and 10% was out of state. Today, it's probably 60-40. We have an investment in San Jose. The next investment we're getting ready to do is going to be in North Carolina. And then the one after that will be here in Austin. So we're very comfortable investing in Texas as well as, you know, across the U.S.
Okay, good. Thank you. Morgan?
So I work with Silverton Partners. Silverton Partners is an early stage venture capital firm based here in Austin. We tend to focus on tech investing, although we sometimes do broader based investments. Really what our focus is partnering with passionate, exceptional entrepreneurs who are either attacking growth markets or looking to disrupt a large existing industry, typically with a proprietary product or service. We really kind of span the gap between what an angel would invest. So sometimes we do, you know, seed 200, 500K type of investments all the way through to kind of what you'd consider like a more typical Series A VC round, you know, $4 or $5 million, with the idea that we wouldn't invest more than kind of seven or so over the life of company.
That's perfect. Yeah, thank you. Andrew.
I'm Andrew Busey. I'm relatively new to Austin Ventures, coming from the entrepreneurial side. So Austin Ventures has done a lot of different size deals over the past, including big roll-ups like HomeAway, which was over $200 million of investment, which went public recently, and Bizarre Voice, which was an early stage investment, which also just went public recently. My focus is really going to be very early stage stuff, which I think some people in Austin perceive that maybe Austin Ventures hasn't been very focused on recently, so hopefully that will change. We'll actually look at investments now in the couple hundred thousand dollar range, but really the focus is probably more in the traditional Series A, kind of $2 to $7 million range.
Perfect. Thank you. And actually, Andrew, I think we're going to stay with you here for a minute. You've alluded to the trickle-down effect, speaking of companies that have gone public here in Austin, and I know you've been a long-time Austin resident. You want to talk a little bit about, for the people who are not necessarily from Austin, some of the early companies that have had a significant impact on Austin technology?
Sure. I think entrepreneurship in some ways is a little bit of a momentum play at the community or city level. So I think one challenge that Austin has had in the past is that some of these waves have come and they've generated a lot of entrepreneurial activity and great companies, and then sometimes those waves have ebbed a little bit. And I think we're entering a new phase right now where we're seeing a big wave coming that I hope will change and create a much deeper, lasting entrepreneurial infrastructure here. I think if you look back to like the late 90s, I started my first company in Austin at the end of 1995, early 96. So I've been an entrepreneur in Austin for a very long time. There were a couple of companies, Tivoli and Trilogy, which were instrumental in bringing a lot of talent to Austin in the early to mid 90s, driving a lot of growth. And I think those companies spawned a lot of the entrepreneurs that were kind of the next wave. So now we've got companies like Bizarre Boys and HomeAway, which, you know, they're newly public, so I don't think people will be leaving them very soon. But as these companies like those companies become very successful, and then a bunch of bigger companies or well-known companies from Silicon Valley now have big offices in Austin through either home-growing them or acquisitions, like Zynga has probably 250 people here. Facebook probably has 250-plus people here. I think eBay also is probably about that size. Lots of people are now building these organizations here. I think that will spawn a lot of new entrepreneurial activity and will also give new startups a lot of access to talent that has been through kind of what they need.
Perfect. Okay. And Jamie, you alluded to this a little earlier, just in terms of the fact that everyone knows how great it is to live in Austin, Texas. We are almost obsessive about bragging about how fantastic the lifestyle is here in Central Texas. And I think it's also pretty evident, I heard a statistic the other day from the chamber that the Austin population has doubled every 20 years since it has been created. So do you want to maybe tell us a little bit more about the collaborative nature or what it's like from an investor standpoint? What is Austin's most competitive advantage is probably the question.
Well, I think Austin's most competitive advantage, frankly, is the environment. And now I'm not talking as an entrepreneur. By the way, I am a serial entrepreneur first and an angel funder second and a bunch of other things after that. Austin's just a lovely place. The beginning of the hill country here. And for the 40-something years I've lived here, it's the kind of place where you could get cheap tacos and cold beer. And that's a really nice thing. And it's actually, that's sort of become smoke and mirrors, because now I live out in Westlake, and Westlake's kind of like Palo Alto. You know, there's valet parkers at the HEB when you go to the grocery store. But we still maintain this lovely situation where you can get great Tex-Mex cheap, you can get good margaritas cheap. It's just a great place to be. And I think that environment, just like California having perfect weather, plays an underlying role that the chamber nor entrepreneurs or anybody else can claim credit for. That said, we do have a great entrepreneurial spirit here. We've got lots of people that are creative. And my assessment 6 years ago was we had lots of smart entrepreneurs, but we didn't have enough dollars to help get those startups going. So I founded the Angel Network. That pendulum swings back and forth. Sometimes it seems like we don't have enough dollars for all the great entrepreneurs. Sometimes it seems like we've got enough dollars, although you kind of never have enough. But we've got lots of dollars, and we need smarter entrepreneurs. In Silicon Valley and in Boston, the entrepreneurs are smart. They're all PhDs that have been at Google or someplace, and that's a real advantage. In Austin, we're trying to make up that ground, and we are trying hard, and we're doing fine, I think.
I think so, too. Morgan, you probably coined one of the headlines from this panel, which is that you believe that in Austin you can invest less and make more. Do you want to elaborate on that for us?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, you know, I think there's been a lot of focus on the investor side. It, you know, capital efficiency is kind of a huge buzzword. You know, everybody wants to have a small VC fund and invest in, you know, capital efficient businesses. Not a lot of emphasis goes through to why that's important for entrepreneurs. And the base reason why that's the case is, you know, the less money you raise, typically, the more of the company you own, so that when that exit happens or you continue to run the business, you know, your financial incentives and your rewards for the risk you've taken are greater. And I actually think Austin is probably the best place in the country to build a capital-efficient business. And how I'll explain that just briefly is to kind of compare and contrast it with Silicon Valley, because, you know, I was there, I started a company, was part of two other companies, all three kind of got sold, and then I'd be VC out there for 2 or 3 years before I came out here. So I have a little bit of a background, also born and raised out there, kind of what's going on. And what I would say is, there's no question that the Bay Area is the most active, biggest kind of ecosystem for tech stuff, you know, in the world. No one really disputes that. But, you know, the flip side to that is it's very competitive, and it's also very hard to kind of break through and get attention. And the ecosystem has kind of adapted to that fact. And how they've adapted is the investors, they want to put in huge amounts of money. They really want to pronounce winners early. You know, as an entrepreneur, whether you like it or not, you're kind of forced to compete with, you know, the Facebooks and the Zyngas and the other companies that have raised $100 million and can afford to pay an engineer directly out of school, you know, $250,000. And, you know, that's not necessarily a bad thing. Competition isn't a bad thing. But if you're trying to build a capital-efficient business, it is a bad thing, as is kind of the cost of living and the expense of office space and all those other things. And so, you know, if you're really subscribed to the philosophy of, you know, hey, I want to get somewhere on a couple million bucks, Austin's great for that. It's, you know, there's less ambient noise. There are great engineers here that you don't have to pay quite the same price because the cost of living in Austin is less. And that's really important as an entrepreneur and as starting your own business. And just to kind of drive that point home, I mean, you know, we're an investor in a company here in town called Unbound ID. This raised $3 million. It's an enterprise software company, by the way. You know, booked $20 million in sales last year. And I don't say that like, oh, wow, you know, what an impressive company. But you will never find that in the Bay Area. Because, you know, there are companies clearly that are that successful and have done that in that amount of time. But they would have raised, you know, $40, $50 million by now because they can. And that's the difference. And what I'd say is, you know, if you continue that success and you raise a lot of money, but you build a billion-dollar company, you know, and everybody likes to talk about those examples, that's great. But if you kind of fall off the track, which 95 or 99% of companies do, not to say they're not great companies, but they're not billion-dollar outcomes, then you've kind of gotten to the point where you've ramped up your expense rate, you raise a lot of money, you kind of forced to continue to raise money, and you end up being an employee in the business you founded. So if you don't want to do that, you know, Austin is a very viable kind of place to consider.
That's fantastic. Okay. And so ATC, part of ATC's role within the region here is to collect data from tech company CEOs. And a survey that we conducted last fall indicated that at any one time, two-thirds of our CEOs are looking for capital. And we were delighted to learn that almost 70% of them said that there was really not necessarily an issue in terms of securing capital. So we're very happy about that. A lot of our companies have access, clearly, to local sources of capital. But I think the other thing that we're seeing is that, and Rudy, you alluded to this, we'll lead off with you, firms such as G51, Silverton, and I know Austin Ventures also, you guys like to bring in outside partners, maybe for second round. You want to elaborate a little bit on that?
Yeah, I mean, I think, so part of G51's mantra from the very beginning was to be able to access capital outside of Texas, and our current mantra is connecting Texas and technology. But as we did that, you know, the second deal I seeded, Kleiner Perkins, this was in 1997, Kleiner Perkins came in and was our syndicate partner in our Series B. And so that was really exciting, helped put us on the map a little bit, and then helped give us a little street cred with some of the VCs on the West Coast. And then, you know, after that, there was Polaris Ventures, and after that, Bain Capital, today we've got and Morgan's in this deal with us. You know, we're syndicated with Morgan Stanley and Floodgate, and a deal that G51. We did the Series A. Our partner is Foundry out of Boulder, And so, you know, people are interested in what's happening here in Texas. And more importantly, investors are interested in getting into, you know, extremely high potential, exciting companies. And so to the extent we do a good job at helping entrepreneurs be successful in building a really exciting company, there's no shortage of interest from syndication partners across the country to invest here locally in Austin.
Very good. Morgan, do you want to add, or Andrew, to that from the venture perspective, and then we'll go to Jamie.
So I'm relatively new to venture, but companies that I've funded or founded have raised money from Sequoia and Mayfield and NEA. I don't think it's a problem to get any of the big guys in California to come here and to invest here if the company's exciting and the entrepreneur is great.
That's well said. And Jamie, from the angel investor perspective, you just hosted 500 of your closest angel friends here in Austin. Give us a
sure.
report from the national conference, if you would.
That's right. So angel investing, like all types of investors, is sort of all over the map. But there's a number of us who've organized and we're members of the Angel Capital Association, which is spun out of the Kauffman Foundation. And that's a group who look at it, take angel investing very seriously and want to do it better constantly, want to share best practices and be smart money. And we have an annual summit every year, and it usually goes back and forth from the East Coast to the West Coast. So last year it was in Boston, next to MIT. The year before it was in Silicon Valley. This year we brought it to Austin, and it was great. And everybody, all the 500 angel investors from around the country showed up, and they loved Austin. They love. We put on kind of a Texas show. We had the chancellors of the University of Texas, Texas State University, and Texas A&M University come in and just not really make a speech, but take 5 minutes to say, "Welcome to Texas. We're glad you're here." And the governor showed up, and he made a great speech. He just talked for about 10 minutes, but when he talks about his pro-business stance, you get it. You understand, you know what, if you're building a business in Texas, that the government itself doesn't want to overregulate you or overtax you. We want you to build a successful business. We want lots of Dells and National Instruments and Whole Foods. And so it was a great success, and we had a lot of fun. And next year it'll be back in San Francisco, actually.
That's very good. So everyone knows that getting great attention as a market and perhaps relocating executive talent or relocating a company are two totally different things. Everyone knows that Austin has had a lot of buzz here lately, not just for politics, but for business and for technology. And I think each of you has probably had experience in relocating companies or executive talent. I'd like actually for each one of you guys to maybe tell us a story or two, any opportunities or challenges. Morgan, we can lead with you.
Yeah, sure. So we've relocated a couple companies here to Austin in the last few years. I guess I'll just go through one example. It's a company called Sparefoot. They're a online marketplace for self-storage. The story there is, you know, we have an incubator here in town. It's very similar to like a Techstars or a Y Combinator. It's called Capital Factory. And Josh Baer, who I don't think is here, has done a wonderful job putting that together. In any event, these guys came into town for that. From Southern California. And when they got here, I think their expectation was we're going to go through the program and then we're going to, you know, move back to California and continue to run the business. And, you know, obviously they stuck around. And part of the reason why they stuck around was, one, I think, you know, they were impressed by the level of mentorship in that program and just the depth of talent and expertise here in Austin, which is great. But the other thing was, you know, I think, you know, again, to the distraction and kind of the propensity in some of the hotter markets to kind of not look beyond just the initial kind of sexy pitch. I mean, these guys are in the market that is self-storage, right? Like the most unsexy market you could possibly imagine for technology. I'm talking about like the 5x8 units that you like put your couch in when you go home for summer for college or whatever. So I think, you know, the reception that they got, you know, in California when they were talking about raising money was pretty standoffish in the sense that, you know, who wants to talk about, you know, that market. And I think the reception they got here in Texas, just because it's a little bit smaller of a community and people took the time to look a little bit deeper, including us, you know, we ended up funding the deal, was, you know, that little non-tech market that everybody thinks is so unsexy is huge. So to give you an example, Public Storage, which probably owns, 5-6% of the market, has a $20 billion market cap. And 85% of the industry is one to two kind of operators that own one to two facilities. And so those guys have no propensity to kind of put their inventory online, to market it, to compete against the bigger companies. So understanding that story and seeing it was really exciting. And I think, you know, part of the reason we were able to do that is because we're in a little bit lower noise of environment. And the other thing is, you know, those guys are now the largest marketplace ever. They were able to do that, again, only raising like $3.5 million. You know, they'll do north of $10 million this year in revenue. Again, that wouldn't happen in Silicon Valley. You know, those, the founders are 24. They still own the vast majority of the business. And the reason why they're able to do that is they got people to work at substantially below market salaries, you know, salaries that wouldn't even be sustainable in Palo Alto because of the fact, one, you know, those guys did a great job of setting culture and getting people excited about the idea and willing to do that, but two, because the Austin ecosystem and the cost of living and, you know, the fact that, you know, there aren't the companies throwing huge paychecks at every single person that walks down the street kind of allowed them to do that.
Fantastic. Okay. And I think everyone knows, speaking of UT and A&M, that Texas is really home to some of the country's finest universities. Jamie, I know you've been doing some work with A&M in terms of their commercialization program. I'd like for you to, if you don't mind, tell us a story or two about that and the role that you believe university efforts in commercialization play in feeding the local tech ecosystem here.
So I think that's very important. And, of course, Stanford is part of what makes Silicon Valley so great. And we have a number of great universities here in the state of Texas. And the University of Texas at Austin is a great example, Tier 1 university, over $600 million in sponsored research every year. Texas A&M, its flagship university in College Station, which is about 100 miles from here. Same thing, over $600 million in sponsored research every year. And then Texas State and some of the universities in that system may have $10 or $20 million worth of sponsored research, which is not a lot, but everybody in Texas is getting the, getting the right attitude, these many professors. And in fact, one of the problems that's been noted is professors are not incented to commercialize their technology. Well, we're trying to change that in the state. And in fact, Texas A&M University has changed their incentive program so that commercialization efforts, that is patenting your research and helping to get it out to the world, counts toward tenure at A&M University. And hopefully many of our other universities will follow that example. What that does, I like to point out to entrepreneurs that you don't have to have rocket science to have a great company. If you've got the next great soft drink, we can create a lot of wealth and have a lot of fun, and you can get funding for that. That said, rocket science is pretty neat, and we might need to save the planet. We might need to feed the planet. And so that's going to come from our research labs at our great universities. And University of Texas and Texas A&M are leaders in their field in a variety of engineering and agriculture and energy. And so many of us are working to try and get that technology out to entrepreneurs to start companies. And it's pretty damn difficult, really, because it's so early stage. In fact, I'll tell you one example. A&M has a lot of healthcare work, life sciences stuff going on. And I had a professor come to me. So what I do is I help professors. I find technology and I help pair it with entrepreneurs and funding and get startups created on the great research at A&M. And I've helped UT do that before, and I've helped Texas State do that. And a professor at A&M came to me a few weeks ago, and he said fungal infections kill millions of people all over the planet every year. He said there's no good cure for fungal infections. There's topical creams that don't work that well. And he had a pill that would cure fungal infections, and it's a $7 billion market right now for those creams. So this would take over the market. Well, I perked up. This is great, although I have been doing this now for a matter of months, and I've learned a series of questions to ask. And so I asked this professor these questions, and one of them was, so what have you done to demonstrate this actually is a cure for fungal infection? And his answer was, well, I saw it work in a test tube, and I gave a mouse a shot, and it didn't die. So in his view, you know, it's done. He's got a cure, and that's it.
It's a minimum viable product.
So in my view, I said, well, that's great. You know, a couple more years of research, a few more mice actually curing a fungal infection in them instead of whether they die or not from this. And we might have something to start a company around. So the problem with university technologies is they're very early stage, and professors don't get it. But we're all working very hard to help the professors to get it and to come up with elegant ways to move these technologies along so they are right for startups.
So, Rudy, I think in the same vein.
Yeah, in the same vein, you kind of went on a lot about A&M there. But in the same vein, you know, what I can say is, you know, if you think back about the development of just fantastic universities across the country, you can look at MIT and you can look at Stanford and you can look at different groups. And I'd say Texas is, we're just beginning. We're just getting started. Our dean of the business school is from USC. Our dean of the engineering school at UT is from Berkeley. We've got a fabulous position to take over the Office for Technology and Commercialization open right now. We think sort of the legs or the stool are being put in place to where there's just a couple of more pieces of the puzzle that we've got to match up, and then we're just going to be able to blow the doors off, you know, commercializing new great technologies that are going to be coming out of the universities. And we certainly look to UT and A&M to lead the charge on those fronts. But, you know, there's Rice University. There's a lot of smart guys down at Rice and others around the state. So we look at the universities as just an unending pool of talent that's going to continue to create the best and brightest with solutions that are going to help us, you know, change the planet and do great things in the future. So now's a perfect time to jump on board this ship as Austin and Texas really starts to rumble and take off.
And speaking of young talent, if we sort of switch the perspective here to the entrepreneurial or the young student entrepreneur perspective, do you want to tell us a little bit about your Venture Fellows program?
Yeah, thanks. So one of the things that G51 did early on is really just to help out UT, we teamed up and started what we call the G51 Venture Scholars Program. So we work with MBA students at the University of Texas. That was in 2001. In 2005, one of our venture partners, who was a co-founder in Perot Systems, said, hey, why don't we do that? You know, I got my MBA at Baylor. Let's do it at Baylor. So we turned it on at Baylor, and we're working with Baylor graduate students. And then we started seeing the network effect of having lots of young, really bright people come through our doors and go out into the marketplace and do great things. So we've now turned on the business school at Duke. We've turned on Boston College, and we're basically taking this program across the country. We'd look to have between 10 and 20 universities over the next 24 months or so. And then we think it also is an opportunity to scale internationally somewhere down the line. But what these students are able to do is they come in, they basically work as an associate of our fund. They go through, you know, we see about 1,000 companies a year. And so during the course of half a year, they'll see, you know, 500 companies. And it's just a great learning experience for these students that some have had work experience and some are more technical and some are aspiring entrepreneurs to come in. And what they walk away with is they absolutely leave our shop knowing what a fundable deal is. And that perspective's been real exciting. The other two things they do is, A, they'll do special projects for our portfolio companies, and then, B, they'll do special projects for G51 as well. So that's been magic sauce to G51 that, you know, a lot of people don't know about, so we're excited to start sharing it. And it's been interesting because we'll work with the students on a remote basis. So an entrepreneur will come in to pitch our firm, and there'll be 8 or 10 people in the room, and there'll be, you know, 6 on video conference. And, you know, when you do that, you get great perspectives from, you know, some 50-somethings, some 40-somethings, some 30-somethings, and some 20-somethings about the concept and criteria that you're trying to base an exciting startup around. So it's been a really great program for us. We're real excited about it.
That's good. We're going to stay on an entrepreneur-focused path here. Actually, and Andrew, I heard you espouse some fantastic wisdom to entrepreneurs earlier. Tell us a little bit about what you're seeing now as part of Austin Ventures, but also just as an individual investor. Impart some wisdom to our entrepreneurs looking for funding.
Sure. First, I'm going to add the one bullet point that no one said, which I think is a great reason to come to Austin and be an entrepreneur or join an early stage company. From California, we have zero state income tax. So which includes capital gains. So we saw, and at Zynga actually, we saw a lot of people that, like, you could tell who the really smart people were because they would be like, oh, Zynga's about to go public. My options are about to be worth something. I'm going to transfer to the Texas office for a year. So that was a good internal recruiting thing for us. In terms of entrepreneurship, I mean, I think one thing that's great in Austin right now is we are seeing this sort of resurgence of really fast growing companies that are, we've had a couple of big IPOs. I think we'll have a couple more IPOs this year, next year. We've got these big companies from the West Coast building significant offices. I believe this is Facebook's biggest office outside of California. I know that between Dallas and Austin that this is, Zynga's got more people here than anywhere besides their headquarters. So there's a lot of that going on, and what that does is that I think exposes entrepreneurs to people and experiences that turn them in, that sort of harden them and give them the background that they need to go be successful entrepreneurs. Because if I saw a deal that I wasn't super excited about or an entrepreneur that I thought was a diamond in the rough, I would and they hadn't done it, I would say go work in a startup because that's the best thing that you can do because you really need to see what it's about. And partially everyone does what they know. In my first job out of college, I was like employee number 10 at a little company that was making data visualization tools that they'd licensed from the National Center for Supercomputing Applications. I found this company because I was trying to start a company. I didn't know how venture capital worked. So I cold called every software company in the Champaign, Illinois phone book. There were like seven. These guys said, well, we can't fund you, but we'll hire you. They ended up getting this license from NCSA for this other technology called Mosaic, which became the precursor to all the web stuff. And I learned a lot from that. I learned what a pivot was for sure because they were doing data visualization software, which wasn't really growing. And then boom, they called this internet wave. I learned about commercialization from universities. And I learned a lot about how startups grow. And I think that those are very important things. And I think that's probably Silicon Valley's biggest advantage over anywhere else is there's just so much stuff going on there all the time that getting that experience is relatively easy. It's been harder here because we've had a little bit of a startup dark ages in the mid-2000s, and now I think we're starting to see a huge renaissance, and I think that's going to be great for Austin and great for bringing people here and also great for new homegrown entrepreneurs.
I totally agree, and I want to emphasize your point, Andrew, about the prevalence of mid-market and enterprise-level organizations here in Austin, Texas. I think the market itself and the Chamber of Commerce, everyone really here in Austin has done such a great job of branding Austin as being very entrepreneurial-friendly, and thank God for that, right? But we also were really, I think, especially with the move of Apple, really gaining some legitimacy here just in terms of being a tier one market for technology. One or two quick questions here, and then we'll open it up to the audience. Any mistakes that you guys see entrepreneurs make when they pitch their companies? Anything?
They make lots of mistakes.
Yeah.
But we all make lots of mistakes, right? And so I'd say, the first thing is really understand where you are in the development of your business and try to, two things. One, don't be afraid to get on someone's radar kind of early on. But two, be sensitive to knowing when they typically invest and try to understand where you are in the development of your company. I mean, for G51, if you're just starting to develop your product, maybe you want to send us a summary of what your vision for the company is, but check back with us when you have your beta product up and going, because that's, you know, or when you're on the back end of your alpha and you're ready to launch your beta, you know, that's because that's our sweet spot for investing. And so be sensitive to sort of where your investors are in the realm of things and try to right size and match both your development stage of company and maybe the opportunity that you're dealing with the investors that you're talking to.
That's great advice. Jamie, you're kind of known as the entrepreneur's investor. Any advice or?
Well, so one that comes to mind from an experience I had here at South by Southwest many years ago is be teachable. That is, when you ask somebody, any of us investors, you know, what you tell us about your company, listen carefully to the answer and don't be defensive. Sometimes you'll get BS. There's a bunch of standard problems like your valuation's too high. But lots of time you'll get meaningful feedback. And so listen to it, consider it. As you hear, collect data by talking to many investors, add it all up, and improve your business plan and your story from learning.
So I think one thing to sort of follow on that I look for and I've always thought is really important, and it sounds like really simple, and I, you know, maybe it is, but I've seen it not happen, so therefore I know everyone doesn't do it. But like if I meet with someone 1 week and then it's kind of interesting and I want to follow up with them, I follow up with them 2 or 3 weeks or a month later, and there hasn't been like dramatic evolution, it's really kind of scary for me that this person's not really either listening or a truly committed entrepreneur, because your business should be, you know, making great strides. Like even if you have a job and you're not, you know, you haven't quit and you're not like, it's not your full-time thing, if you're really serious about it, you should be making significant progress. So, yeah, I just would add that.
I think that's a great point. I've heard you talk about commitment and hard work, too.
That's kind of a required part of making that progress.
Yeah. Very good. Okay, I'd like, before we open up, for each of you to tell us one or two companies that you guys are keeping an eye on. It can be in your portfolio or outside of your current book of business.
You want me to start?
Yeah, go for it, Andrew. Yeah.
Since I'm new, I have a couple of things that aren't I can't talk about yet, but I think I wish I could talk about them, but I can't. Really early stage deal that I think is really going to be interesting. It's called Feel Rich. You can follow them on Twitter, twitter.com/feelrich, doing video production and content and community stuff around urban lifestyle. So the tagline is health is the new wealth, and it's really about exposing people to lifestyle choices and empowerment. So, you know, you might want the Bentley that Jay-Z has, but you know, that's a difficult goal to achieve, but you can be, you know, ripped like 50 Cent if you work, because that doesn't cost money. So we're working with actually 50 Cent and Paul Wall and Fat Joe and a bunch of rappers who have, you know, been through some challenging life experiences. Like Fat Joe said, he's had more friends die of heart failure and diabetes in the last year. It used to be all of his friends died in gang shootings and things like that, you know, 20 years ago, and now it's like, oh my God, health matters a lot more than these other things. So it's been a really interesting, different company, but check it out.
Will you be ripped like 50 Cent next year at this?
Oh, come on, man.
So I guess the takeaway is don't be fat and a gangster. If you don't get shot, you're probably going to die of a heart attack.
I'll tell you, I don't know about you guys. I've been real fascinated by dueling banjo playoff between Highlight and Glancy, and I think it's an interesting space, and we've been visiting with them a little bit, and I think, you know, when you look at opportunities that break open and are real compelling, you know, don't just go for, you know, the easiest path. I mean, think about monetization, and sometimes monetization opportunities aren't sort of the first blush of the idea of, you know, when you're trying to launch. Sometimes there's other patterns around your application that show up and that are just natural based on the way you design it. What I'm saying by that is when I look at a Glancy and I look at a Highlight, Glancy the look, just by the nature of the way they've laid it out, it looks and feels much more like a business-related kind of an app that you that could survive in a business environment. And that can manifest in a very different business model, revenue model, than if you say, you know, you want to be a highlight, you're going to be in the consumer space. That's a very different model. And so it's early in the game around the, both of these in this area, but it's also an opportunity for some of these companies to sort of stake out their territory early and, you know, be the winner by figuring out the model quickly and moving in that direction. So I think that's been a lot of fun to visit with those guys and see what they're up to.
A lot of good trends. Morgan?
I'm just going to say Black Locus, which is in our portfolio, and Main Street Hub, which is not. And I'm not going to tell you why because I want to get the questions, but they're both cool companies.
Yeah. Jamie, companies?
Sure. I'll tell you about one. I think it's important because it's a life sciences company, and life sciences is very difficult for most of us to fund because it takes so much money. And I'm working with an MD Anderson cancer researcher that might have a cure for cancer. Now, he'd never say it that way. This is the way I say it, a cure for cancer. But what he's the normal route there is hundreds of millions of dollars in 10 years for phase 1, 2, and 3, for large animal, then phase 1, 2, and 3 testing. So it's like, but there's nothing we can do. Well, in describing it to me, he said the thing that got him excited was he started, did some large animal trials, and it turns out dogs, lots of dogs have non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. And so he started treating dogs. It's a T-cell therapy. Pull the cells out, process them, put them back in, and your own immune system kills the tumor. And so he's telling me how he's got data from dogs, and he actually needs more, lots, hundreds of dogs. And at the same time, I have two wonderful black labs that are part of the family, and one of them has cancer. It's not non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, but it's some big nasty thing that we constantly have it cut out, and we give it our dog chemotherapy and all this. And I happened to ask my wife, isn't that expensive? And she wouldn't tell me how much it costs to treat the dog. And when I finally found out, it was enough to buy a car. And so at the same time, this doctor's telling me we need more large animal trials and we need to fund that somehow to get to phase 1, 2, and 3 human trials for this cure for cancer. And I know that my family has written huge checks just blindly and will continue to because we love this dog. So we are now trying to form a veterinary company that will treat cancer in dogs because my anecdotal evidence says people will write big checks to extend the life of their dog. And we're hoping through doing that we actually create a vibrant, growing $10 to $20 million a year company that is collecting data directly applicable to taking this cure for cancer to humans. So I think that's fun. I like trying to solve the unsolvably huge problems, and this seems like perhaps one way that we might be able to do that.
It's a great story. Okay, questions? Coming up to the mic.
Hi, we're a bootstrap company. We don't currently need any funding or necessarily.
Hello?
There
you go. We're a bootstrap company. We don't currently need any funding and really don't want any right now, but we know that at some point we might need some to scale. Do you have any advice for opening up conversation with VCs given that situation?
Yeah, I mean, I think the best way to get introduced to a VC is through a relationship that they already have. So whether it's an investor that co-invests with them a lot, or an entrepreneur that's worked with them before, or that has a relationship with them, or even a service provider, that has some kind of a connection in, that really helps, because if it's just a cold email in and there's no kind of personal connotation in it, those probably get read less than the other ones. It really has to stand out. So I'd say find a personal connection and then try to distill it down. A paragraph or two in an email, and then maybe some supporting kind of data on why you're excited about it, and that should do it.
All right, thanks.
Can I ask how much money you think you're going to need?
A lot.
Are you?
No, right now we currently have a lot of large national brands that we're working with. So we have a pretty good revenue stream, but I could foresee at some point, you know, needing between 5 and 10 million to scale a sales force.
And how, what do you think your revenues will be at the point when you need that?
I think we'll probably be in the $5-6 million revenue.
Okay. Well, so you know, that's what you need to think about when you come to people and you're asking for more money than your company currently takes in.
Right.
You know, the valuation wise, you might be giving up a tremendous amount of your company.
Which is why we don't want to do anything right now, for sure. So we're going to continue on our path. We kind of have about a 25% to 30% growth rate right now.
Exactly. So if you just want to build a $1 billion company, then take all the money you can, give up your company, and I mean, give up huge. A piece of your company. But if what you want to do is walk home with money at the end of the day, then you need to do the calculation of how much money can you take to get to the next level where maybe an acquisition is appropriate and you still own a whole lot of the company.
Okay. Thanks. That's good advice.
Appreciate y'all being here today. So we're probably 2.5-year-old company. We're in the real estate space. This is the second deal in this space. And we kind of serve a gap that two of the larger players don't serve. And we're in conversations with one of them who's saying, hey, we may build, we may buy. And they're folks I've known for a while and I trust them, but I know it's business. And so I'm struggling with how much do we show them with our future feature set and how much of our development platform do we share with them versus just being strategic partners and continuing on the path that we are. Because I know that they've said to me, we're in the decision-making if we're going to build or buy. Every executive is saying, we're not going to build it, we're not going to build it. But I still have my intuition saying, you know, but it's a great opportunity. I want to be humble about it. I want to be wise about it. But in your experience of selling companies, when's it appropriate? And we could have all the legal agreements signed and docked, but I'm not a litigious person. So in NDAs and non-competes and all that stuff, what am I going to spend 3 years pursuing them? So practically speaking, what would you guys do if you were in my shoes, and how should I be thinking right now?
Well, go ahead.
I just went through this about 2 years ago with Zynga, and it was challenging because they're, you know, I don't know which companies you're talking about, but Zynga's, you know, corporate development maybe is known as being very aggressive.
Sure.
You know, my personal opinion is if your business is good, it doesn't really matter that much. I mean, I never thought, hey, they're just going to come in and look at all our code and rip stuff off.
Yeah.
I mean, if they can do that easily, you don't have any protection anyway. So I my stance is, and I've been through this like 3 or 4 times, is always just to be mostly open unless I absolutely don't trust them. And then I might look at my roadmap and take off like 3 or 4 really like things that I think are brilliant that they don't really need to know about, because you don't want like to give them an idea a year and a half out, because they maybe could steal that and do it. But it's probably not that predictable anyway.
Well, the reason I'm a little cautious is because I had a failed leverage buyout. I was acquiring a company. LBO failed. They wanted $4 million at the closing table. We decided not to do it. We decided to get in that business anyway, and I could have bought that business at the liquidation value at foreclosure. I mean, 4 years later, I could have bought everything at an asset value because we decided to compete. Hmm. So we were looking at buying, decided not to. The capital markets kept saying, build it, don't buy it. So we decided to build it, and then we put them out of business, and at the auction, I could have bought it for 1/100th of the value that we were trying to. So I'm not saying I'm a bad person, but that is business. You know, so.
Sure, it's business. You know, also time to market and how important the time to market piece of their equation is can kind of be a little tail that they can let out. And usually you start getting bits and pieces of feedback from the executives that you're talking to see how, you know, interested they are in your company. And, you know, and if they're expressing interest, then I mean, they're typically pretty interested.
Well,
but you also have to weigh the buy versus build around the business that you've got. And, you know, there was used to be sort of a number that people talked about for acquisitions in and out of Dell, and it used to be about $20 to $25 million. And if it was in the early days of Dell, if it was over $25 million, they just do it themselves. If it was under $25 million, then they might buy your company. So,
well, timing is everything. It would take them 24 months. Even if I laid out the vision and the code, they're doing 20 different things. And so that's the primary reason why they're considering this.
Okay. We wish you luck.
Thanks. Yeah, absolutely. I want to make sure we have time for everybody. We have just a few minutes left.
Okay. Just a quick question. I've got two of them. One, I didn't hear Texas Tech at all. Why didn't I hear Texas Tech?
Guns
they give
up,
out
baby.
Degrees
guns
there,
up.
Too.
Yeah. Guns up.
I spent 6 years there. I'm not a doctor. So the other was, I've heard talent and technology. Apple's coming in, 3,600 jobs. That's a lot. Obviously, they're not all going to be engineers. But as this talent pool gets slimmer and slimmer, and you've got companies like your Facebook and Google and Apple moving in, what are these companies that you invest your money in, what are they doing to attract that top talent, retain it, and grow their companies from that sense?
Well, so at the earliest stages, people are just kind of coming together to go do something wonderful, and there's that sort of, you know, the entrepreneur vision that gets them up and going. After that, it really depends on the momentum that you're building around the company you're starting up. And when we've had companies that are showing great momentum, we've been able to recruit. That when we've had companies that are hitting breakout, that's when it starts getting hard. When you have to go from 12 to 50, that's when it starts getting hard. I don't know, Morgan, if you want to.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of view those big companies kind of having a presence here as a huge positive, mainly because, you know, the really talented, sought-after engineers are going to evaluate the opportunity that they choose to be a part of, and there's no way, you know, Apple or Facebook or any of these companies at this point can sit there and credibly say, you know, we're going to, you know, earn you, you know, 50 times your money in the next 3 or 4 years. I mean, these are established companies that where the equity value has substantially still been, you know, has already been created. And so I kind of view those companies as training pools for the real entrepreneurs who are going to go there. They're going to work for a few years. They're going to get some great experience. And then, you know, when they want to knock the cover off the ball and start their own business and reap the economic rewards for that and not just get paid, you know, a salary and get a few stock options, that they'll go out and realize that they should start our own company. And when they do that, we'll be there to fund them. So
I appreciate the answers.
Hi, my name is Omar Nassif, and I'm with Yomobi.com. I had a couple of questions. My first is, how imaginative are VCs, or have you found VCs to be in general? By which I mean, how much information do I need to fill in, or how much can I expect them, based on their experience, to know about the field so that I can give them a vision, and then they'll be able to fill in some of the blanks and realize the potential that's there? That's my first question, which is basically, how much information do I need to provide versus how much can I presume that they know? And the second is, how important is it to show revenue right now versus potential revenue in the future? So I was looking at Pinterest as an example of a company that has millions of users, but they're still trying to figure out their revenue model. Would a company like that be able to attract VCs based on the potential revenue, even if you're not showing revenue right now?
So on consumer internet plays, I think that's a special case, which is what Pinterest is. And it's, you know, a consumer internet play, these guys are raising money at ridiculous prices, but it's because they hit an inflection point. Like, there's just a moment in time where it goes from, you know, being like on a slope like this to a slope like this. If you were one day before the slope became this, they're probably begging for $100,000 from angels. The day after that, they got, you know, Andreessen Horowitz or Sequoia or whoever saying, we'll give you $20 million, right? Because it's rare, and you can't very easily build for that inflection point. That's a side effect of product and timing and luck and a lot of factors that are, I think, difficult to plan for as an entrepreneur. So I would say those are special cases. So
can you get the VCs before the inflection point if they see that there's the potential for the inflection point?
You can, but it's challenging, and it'll be dilutive.
So
it's going to... In a consumer internet play, you should be close or have a clear vision of how the inflection point is going to happen before you seek money, because it shouldn't cost you that much to get there. Because these companies aren't expensive to build. I mean, even Twitter, for example, not expensive to build. It's a matter of getting the adoption. And so you really should be looking at raising a ton of money to buttress your position after you hit the inflection point, not to reach the inflection point, because that's such a big beta element that you're just like, it's hard to predict.
So before that point, though, you can often get angel money if you've got a great plan and a good vision. And with that money, often that can get you going, and you don't need further investment because, once again, the moral of the story is when people come and put a lot of money in your company, they take a lot of equity away. Mm-hmm. So angels might be the answer, especially in one of these businesses that's capital efficient. So $1 million gets you all the servers and all the code developed that you need. Now, the first part of your question I thought was interesting, which is how much do I explain? Mm-hmm. A common problem that I see is entrepreneurs pitching their business. The thing is, what you're pitching is a business, and so it needs to be the value proposition to the investor. And especially if it's not internet-related, if it's high science, I see many people that are giving me a chemistry lesson, for example. And that'll come later. I'll get a chemistry expert to come look at your deal and see if that part of things makes sense. But when you get the chance to talk to an investor, you want to make the point very quickly about why investing in your company is going to make them a lot of money. That is, that your value proposition to investors, how quickly you can grow the company and how big it grows.
But is that based on potential, or do you have to be very specific? Like, do you imagine most investors who are in this field have the ability to kind of fill in the blanks themselves based on their own experiences?
Can I just add something to this?
Please.
So, I think that as an entrepreneur, you kind of think it's your job to always please, like, the venture investor. And just even your question, how do I bring along, a venture investor? It's like, well, think of a three-year-old and explain it, right? But the reality is on an entrepreneur, taking a VC or anybody else on your board, right? Like, they're a partner, right? So if they don't have a base level understanding of your business, like, they're going to be helping to make strategic decisions and they're going to be doing a bunch of stuff that involves your business. And so you should try to find someone who understands your business. And if you're sitting there having to explain someone the economics of how a consumer internet play works, you probably don't have the right investor. And so, look far and broad and try to find someone that matches it up. Now, that having been said, if you're trying to cure cancer or whatever, you're rare that you're going to find a venture investor that has that deep of a subject matter expertise. And, he's right. The real science-y elements should come later. But at a basic level, if you're having to set the stage too much, you're talking to the wrong group or the wrong person. So.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
I'm afraid time is up. But great questions, great engagement, great crowd. You guys know that you were competing against Anthony Bourdain. And I think you did okay. Thanks to each of you. Thanks to our panelists. Great information.